feel a little disrespected. You feel like you're not heard. You feel a little undervalued.
Anchorage teachers are frustrated to be starting the school year without a new contract. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a new study shows that climate change predictions have overlooked a large contributor to carbon emissions.
If we take into account these lakes, we realize, oh, we actually have a significant source of permafrost carbon this century.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Today was the first day of school in Anchorage, and for the second year in a row, teachers are starting the year without a new contract. Teachers aren't talking about a strike, but they did hold awareness-building events this morning. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
Dozens of community members, students, and educators gathered outside of Creekside Park Elementary eating donuts and celebrating the first day of school. Principal Tim Andrew told the crowd that the teachers are starting the year without a contract and asked for their support. Then the group walked into the school, linking arms.
Do we want to do just one long chain?
Sure.
Okay. Chain. All right.
First grade teacher Crystal Whitney says the union hosted walk-ins across the district because they want people to know that teachers are still at work and still care for the students, despite the added stress of no contract.
It just kind of adds some extra burdens. You feel a little disrespected. You feel like you're not heard. You feel a little undervalued. You feel like you have to fight a little bit harder, so you're going to extra meetings for the board to hear you. You're going to extra meetings for the district, the community, all of that to hear you.
She says the negotiations are not just about money. They're also about working conditions and making sure that students are in small classes. Some of the union's requests include additional support for children with special educational needs and giving teachers more flexibility in their lesson planning to accommodate different learning styles. That includes allowing teachers to plan for more recess time if they think their students need it. Todd Hess is the chief human resource officer for the Anchorage School District. He says he met with the teachers' union 6 times over the summer and that negotiations are continuing.
We're engaged in a collective bargaining process, and that's a give-and-take process. And it takes time to work through the issues. And the school board has to look and address the needs of the entire community and try and do what's best for all of our students.
He says the district cannot afford the pay increase the union is asking for, which would total about $57 million over 3 years. He's confident that they will reach an agreement. Teachers are currently continuing under the one-year contract that was signed in early 2018 and expired on June 30th. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
A fierce primary battle is playing out in one of the most conservative parts of the state. The campaign between two House members from Eagle River to take over Senator Anna McKinnon's District G seat is getting increasingly malicious, with both candidates accusing the other of slinging mud. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the primary is turning into a fight over what it means to be a true conservative.
Representative Dan Sadler has lived in the Eagle River Chugiak area for almost 3 decades, during part of which he had a career as a newspaperman at the now-defunct right-leaning Anchorage Times. He and his primary opponent have a long list of issues on which they're generally aligned. Sadler wants to reform education and cut government services to fix the state's deficit.
To those people that say that we've cut to the bone, I would say balderdash. I know there's places to reduce more spending, and those are not even the harsh cuts. Those are difficult, but not harsh.
Sadler wants school vouchers, cuts to Medicaid, and for the state to court more investment from oil companies. Though he originally voted for SB 91, the omnibus crime bill designed to slow prison spending, now Sadler's campaigning for a full repeal. He says that he and his opponent Representative Laura Reinbold, have largely consistent values, but extremely different ideas about how to put them into practice. Sadler points to his record of working within the Republican caucus to bring results to his district. He holds up his committee assignments, bills he's helped guide through the House, and specific budget reductions he's helped implement. His argument is that voters should pick him because he's proven himself adept at pulling the levers of power in Juneau.
Senator is by nature a complicated job that involves work in an established institution with lots of rules. If you can't play by the rules, you cannot be an effective senator. You might be a gadfly, you might be an iconoclast, but you're not actually doing the things and accomplishing the things you claim to want to do.
Call it effective, call it establishment, Sadler's positioning himself as the insider candidate. And he's got the high-level Republican endorsements to prove it, including the seat's outgoing holder, Senator Anna McKinnon. Implicit in this argument is the suggestion, sometimes subtly, sometimes overtly, that this is the approach to governance his challenger lacks.
While my opponent is more polarizing and gets more publicity, I'm much more productive. I'm much more of a workhorse and far less of a show horse.
The jab is at Reinbold and refers to when she was booted from the majority caucus in 2015 after voting against the Republican-drafted budget. Even though it cast her out into the wilderness, Reinbold sticks by the move because she says the spending bill did not align with the party's values.
Our principles, our caucus principles said that we will save for future generations and we will live within their means. I'm an absolute believer in principles. I think if we have principles, we need to stick by our principles.
Similar to her opponent, Reinbold sees public safety imperiled because of SB 91, thinks the state education system needs to be reformed, and believes that the outgoing Senate majority didn't do enough to tighten the state's belt. Also, like candidates on both sides of the partisan divide, Reinbold wants more money for the permanent fund dividend, determined by the old legal formula. Reinbold grew up in Alaska, went to Anchorage Public Schools, and worked in business and healthcare. If Sadler is casting himself as the insider, Reinbold is appealing to voters as the insurgent, touting her record of speaking up for true conservative values, even when it might come at the expense of effectiveness.
He doesn't represent the constituency. He represents the good old boys club in Juneau.
Primary contest between the two has gotten vicious. In interviews, both candidates complained about the other's negative campaigning, but each offered unprompted attacks at the other's voting record, character, and conduct. Both have leveled accusations of misleading mailers and unfair attack ads.
Right. And he sadly voted for dangerous SB 91, creating a crime epidemic.
You're out! I'm the proven, bold conservative leader. Representative
there is a third self-described conservative in the race for Senate District G, but he's running as a Democrat. Oliver Sheese is a retired Marine who vacationed in Alaska during his childhood and moved permanently to Eagle River with his family 3 years ago. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A separate Republican primary race in Anchorage has descended into acrimony and personal attacks. That three-way contest is for District 26, encompassing large parts of South Anchorage. Over the weekend, two political blogs reported that a group connected to candidate Joe Riggs sent a mailer to voters that claimed to be from one of his opponents, touting the opponent's support for gay rights. In a Republican primary in a relatively conservative district, the move is seen as trying to discredit the rival, Albert Fogle, because he's married to a man. Riggs did not respond to multiple messages Monday. The move drew a rare rebuke from Alaska GOP Chairman Tuckerman Babcock, who said the mailer, quote, crossed a line. A third candidate, Laddie Shaw, is also running in the primary race. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, while gubernatorial candidates Begich, Treadwell, and Dunleavy support full permanent fund dividends, Walker says he can't promise that.
I cannot subscribe to a concept that we'll always be able to reach into a savings account because those are almost gone.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
The primary tomorrow will be the first time that Alaska voters weigh in on lawmakers who voted for lower permanent fund dividends. Many of the candidates running for office, including three prominent candidates for governor, have pledged to increase dividends. But it's not clear how they're going to pay for them. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman talked with the candidates for governor about the PFD.
This fall, permanent fund dividends are going to be a lot smaller than they would have been until 2 years ago. Dividends would be just over $2,900 under the formula that was used until then. That's compared with the $1,600 set by the legislature. It would cost a lot more to pay the full amount under the formula, roughly $840 million. Republican candidates Mike Dunleavy and Mead Treadwell both say they support the full PFD. Here's Dunleavy.
I think we have the money where we can afford a full statutory PFD.
And here's Treadwell.
I support that formula.
Democratic candidate Mark Begich also supports a higher PFD, just not as high as the Republicans. He supports a different formula.
And then you would put it in the Constitution. So then the formula is there, so it's very clear.
This year, Begich's formula would have steered another $300 million toward dividends. So individual PFDs would be a few hundred dollars more this year. The one candidate who hasn't promised higher dividends is the incumbent, Independent Governor Bill Walker. He was the first to lower the PFD when he vetoed half of the money in June 2016. He did that because the state has been in an ongoing budget crisis. He noted projections that the permanent fund's earnings reserve will get lower over time without deep cuts to state-paid services. Ultimately, PFDs could entirely disappear.
I cannot subscribe to a concept that we will always be able to reach into a savings account because those are almost gone.
None of Walker's challengers have spelled out exactly how they would pay for higher PFDs. And the size of the problem is significant. Separate from the $840 million cost of a full dividend, there's another $600 million gap in the state budget. The existing gap is set to be covered by the rapidly shrinking piggy bank that's covered state budget shortfalls in the past, the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The combined shortfall would be more than a third of what the legislature budgets for all state agencies. To pay for dividends, Dunleavy says he would look to the permanent fund's earnings reserve. And if the numbers don't add up, he says he'd turn to Alaskans.
The thing is, if we want to change the statutes, in my opinion, we should engage the people of Alaska, at least in an advisory vote.
But the state has a new law that already draws from the earnings to pay for state government. Any additional draw is likely to lower the overall value of the permanent fund in the future. Mead Treadwell says some of the funds to cover the shortfall that would be created by higher dividends would come from developing the state's economy.
And if we do that, we're going to have a corporate income tax that's going to help pay our bills.
Economists say a problem with relying on economic development is that anything that creates new jobs would also draw families to the state that rely on public services. And without a broad-based tax like an income tax or statewide sales tax, new residents could actually cost more money than they pay to the government. Begich says he would look to make more cuts to state government, but says any cuts would be small.
The key word here is sustainable dividend, because if you don't create a sustainable dividend, then you're selling a false good.
Both Begich and Walker say they would make up for any long-lasting budget gap with new revenue. While the House passed an income tax bill last year, it died in the Senate. But Walker says it's important that his challengers be more specific than they have been about how they would pay for shortfalls they'd create by increasing dividends. He says deep spending cuts would be difficult, especially when more spending on public safety is needed.
I think we've got to be careful about, you know, the suggestion of we can cut a way out of this.
One group that will be watching closely what the state government does next is the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation's Board of Trustees. It passed a resolution saying that sticking to a rules-based draw on the fund is critical to the fund's future. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The primary election for State Senate District E is between two candidates involved in a messy appointment process earlier this year. Now, Republican voters from the northern section of the Matanuska-Susitna borough and a stretch from Delta Junction to Valdez must decide between Borough Assemblyman Randall Kowalki and Air Force veteran pilot Mike Schauer, who currently holds the seat. The contest has its roots back about 6 months ago when Governor Bill Walker first tried to appoint Kowalki to the seat vacated by Senator Mike Dunleavy, who resigned to focus on his gubernatorial campaign. Kowalki was not on the list of recommended appointees that district Republicans sent Walker, and members of the GOP Senate majority rejected him.
I was disappointed. I guess when the governor calls you up and ends the phone conversation with hope to be working with you soon, Senator, you know, you kind of think, okay, well, this worked out. And then, of course, it all blew up.
The governor reportedly passed over a sitting representative from the Valley who was on the shortlist after he hung an inappropriate poster outside his office in the Capitol. After Kowalki's rejection, Governor Walker appointed an extreme conservative on the list, only to have that potential appointee withdraw once Facebook posts surfaced in which he compared women to dogs and appeared to promote violence toward abortion providers. Then, in swooped Mike Schauer, the outsider with a clean but very thin political record and a libertarian streak, who had only changed his party affiliation from undeclared to Republican a short time before he was appointed.
The governor probably regrets appointing me, and the Senate might regret confirming me, but, you know, you let a guy in the front door that can think fast on his feet, collect in some way a lot of information, but I have a rebel streak in me. It is, don't tell me what I'm going to do, and I'm not going to play your game, especially if I don't think it's right.
Both Schauer and Kowalki say they support repealing controversial crime legislation known as SB 91 and want an amendment to the state constitution that would protect the permanent fund dividend. But like Dunleavy, who walked away from the Senate Majority Caucus over what he said was a bloated budget, Schauer decided not to caucus with the Republican majority either. Kowalki, on the other hand, intends to join the caucus. He says he wants a seat at the table.
We need to be developing that budget rather than let other people drive our fate. I'm not second-guessing what Mike Dunleavy did at the time he did, but I don't see my doing a service to this district if I plan to spend the next 4 years in the broom closet.
Kowalki also says he doesn't consider himself a politician and repeats that he's only been a borough assemblyman for 1,000 days. Like, that limited amount of time working in government can only be a good thing. At the same time, Kowalki questions Schauer's lack of political experience.
Do I think he deserves a Senate seat? No. I think he literally parachuted in, had no record on much of anything, and politically, and boom, he's the senator.
Kowalki wants the state to do more to foster full staffing of the Alaska State Troopers, a problem felt acutely in his assembly district. Kowalki wants to, quote, right-size government. He says a hard spending limit should only come after deeper analysis of state programs and their costs, including a look at the guaranteed increases in union contracts. Schauer says that's one of the biggest differences between them.
If you don't come in with something that constrains government growth and just does what Randall is suggesting, which is, well, you know, we right-size. What does right-size mean? Another billion in increase? Where do you go with that? That's a very broad term to me that you go, well, I'm going to right-size government. Well, we already went up $500 million this year. Can you afford to go up another $500 million when we're $2 billion short?
Schauer says another big difference between them is the caucus question. He sees it as unethical to trade votes for influence.
The caucus stands against repeal and replace of SB 91, protecting the permanent fund and the Constitution. It stands against any kind of balanced budget act. So if Randall says, I support those things, but he also says he's going to join the caucus, then clearly he doesn't understand how that works.
There may be an even more practical difference between the two candidates. Schauer says he doesn't plan to quit his job as a pilot for FedEx and will have to use extended leave time to attend legislative sessions. As a retiree, Kowalki has fewer work responsibilities. Unless Tuesday's primary for District E is too close to call, it will be clear who Republican voters in the district want squaring off with Susan Kay, the lone Democrat filed for the November general election.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Here's a strange thing about climate change. It's actually making the Arctic a more hospitable place for plants. Some scientists suggest that Arctic plant growth could help blunt the effects of climate change by absorbing carbon from the air. But as Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk reports, a new study led by a Fairbanks scientist explains why the Arctic could emit way more carbon than people expected.
There's a ton of carbon that's stuck in permafrost, the frozen ground under much of Alaska. But at least through the end of the century, climate models predict that thawing permafrost won't contribute much to global warming. That's because those models only incorporate one type of thaw, where the permafrost warms slowly down from the surface. Until now, the models actually show the Arctic absorbing more carbon than it emits, thanks to plants that are growing faster and sucking greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Dave Lawrence is a scientist in Colorado who works on a leading climate model.
Plants grow better when there's higher CO2 concentrations, and the warmer seasons, longer growing seasons, have also led to plant carbon uptake. And so that's kind of a fairly well-known feature we've seen in satellite called the Arctic greening.
But there's another type of permafrost thaw happening too, and it's happening much faster. Scientists have known about it for a long time, but it's not included in the models because it's harder to calculate. The thaw comes from a special kind of lake called a thermokarst lake. They form when permafrost starts thawing and the ground sinks down. Then you get a pool of water that helps thaw even more permafrost around and below it. Microbes eat the unfrozen soil and release methane, and because methane is a really powerful greenhouse gas, it turns out that the thermokarst lakes could have a big impact on global warming. Katie Walter Anthony studies thermokarst lakes at University of Alaska Fairbanks.
If we only think about the gradual thaw process, the conclusions are that within this century, permafrost carbon emissions are not very significant. But if we take into account these lakes, we realize, oh, we actually have a significant source of permafrost carbon this century.
Walter Anthony has spent a long time trying to figure out just how significant these thermokarst lake emissions are. Part of her research has involved using helicopters to fly around near Fairbanks, dangling instruments that map permafrost. Last week, she published a paper with several other scientists. It's the first one to model emissions from thermokarst lakes in relation to the gradual widespread thawing of permafrost. And it says that when you include the lakes, carbon emissions from permafrost in the later part of the century could rise by 100% or more, doubling the current projections. They'd roughly match emissions from land use changes like clearing and burning of forests. That's the second largest human source of greenhouse gas pollution after fossil fuels. Lawrence, the Colorado scientist, says the results will likely lead to a bigger effort to incorporate thermokarst lakes into global climate models.
Up until now, we couldn't really quantify the likely size of this potential feedback, and so we didn't know if it was a 5% thing or a, in this case, they're estimating it's 100%. But when it's a big number like 100%, then it provides the motivation to do that work.
Lawrence says it will probably take several years before emissions from thermokarst lakes can be projected precisely enough to add to a global model. In the meantime, scientists say that the study's results point to the limitations and uncertainties involved with all global climate models and the way that they inform how humans should respond to climate change. The study says thermokarst lakes could be a headwind to any global emissions reduction plan. Walter Anthony's study is published in the journal Nature Communications. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
The governor's climate action leadership team is trying to envision innovative ways to reduce carbon emissions in Alaska. For inspiration, task force members are looking east, to Connecticut, where a state-sponsored bank has loaned millions of dollars for energy efficiency projects. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Bert Hunter has a favorite project the Connecticut Green Bank has helped fund. You can almost hear his eyes sparkling through the phone as he describes it. An old textile mill is being transformed into shops and affordable housing. And on site is a built-in hydroelectric dream.
Literally, a river will run through it.
That river will generate power for the building through two turbines, lowering energy costs for the residents. Hunter is the Connecticut Green Bank's chief investment officer, and he admits this is an unusual project for a conventional bank loan.
Probably wouldn't have gotten off the ground.
He says those barriers to installing energy upgrades can exist for regular homeowners too, not just big, ambitious commercial projects. That's because, in the eyes of a traditional bank, a loan for something like a kitchen remodel is typical.
But if you start talking about, you know, solar and energy efficiency and windows or packages of these types of improvements, you know, most bankers don't know, you know, how to approach that.
Hunter says the concept of renewable energy is still relatively new, which can make traditional banks cautious. But the Connecticut Green Bank has enough leverage to put those lenders at ease. So this all sounds pretty complicated. But the basic principle, Hunter says, could be explained to a preschooler.
I've actually done that. Well, maybe not a four-year-old.
Okay, a brief middle school version. Hunter explains that Connecticut Green Bank partners with credit unions and community banks, acting like a conduit. For residents who apply, that's where the money comes from. And if a homeowner does default on their loan for, say, weatherized windows, it's the Green Bank that shares the burden of paying back those costs. This lowers the perceived risk for lenders. And it's how Hunter says they can offer single-digit interest rates for energy efficiency projects. In the 6 years it's been around, the Connecticut Green Bank has more than doubled its initial investment of $70 million. And states like Alaska are starting to take notice.
We're talking about setting up an enterprise that is going to make money.
Chris Rose serves on Governor Walker's Climate Action Task Force, and he's a big fan of establishing a green bank here. It's included in a draft policy, which is expected to be submitted to the governor next month. Rose thinks Alaskans could save a lot of money by making their homes more energy efficient.
And in the past, the state spent over $500 million to do that very successfully. But we don't have that grant money anymore.
Rose says a system that operates like a business makes a lot of sense. You put money in, and that money comes back in the form of interest. But Alaska has a huge budget deficit. So where would that initial money come from?
I don't think a green bank would be a huge lift. I do think that the issue of where the money is going to come from is a big question. A carbon tax is just one potential source of revenue.
Rose says, look what other states are doing. At least seven have proposed carbon pricing legislation. Alaska should be thinking long term. Connecticut didn't establish its green bank with a carbon tax. It transformed an existing energy program and collects a small fee on utility payments. However Alaska decides to go about it, Bert Hunter from before has some advice. Get the state on board and start with a pot of money.
Alaska is no stranger to making these kinds of investments.
Hunter is talking about Alaska's Permanent Fund Corporation. It invested close to $100 million in a leading financer of renewable energy this year. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. Season 2 of the podcast Midnight Oil from Alaska's Energy Desk is out now. That, just like Alaska News Nightly, is available wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman, Zachariah Hughes, and Nat Herz in Anchorage, and Elizabeth Jenkins and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com.
The statewide primary election is August 21st. Polls open 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. You will be voting for United States Representative, Governor, Lieutenant Governor, State Senator, and State Representative. When you go vote at your polling location, bring one form of identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a questioned ballot. The questioned ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring somebody to assist you. For information about early or absentee voting or polling locations, visit elections.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.